You are listening to This Week in Palestine. Today is Sunday, April 13, 2025. This Week in Palestine offers news from a Palestinian perspective. The following hour may contain views that do not necessarily reflect those of WZBC, Boston College, or its Board of Trustees. Good morning, good evening, wherever you are. This is your guest host, Bethany Marks, and welcome to This Week in Palestine.
Let me show you the land where our memories still live. See those broken stones where the old house once stood. That was our home where we laughed and we loved. That big farm right there with the olives so green. They stole it from us, you know what that means. We harvested life from the roots of these trees. Now they're strangers' hands taking all that we need. Look, son, that was our village. Now it's dust and it's pain. They came from the west with their guns and their chains. But remember these fields, remember our name. One day we'll return, I swear it again. We gathered here, family, under the moon. Stories and songs now all gone too soon. They burned every door, they tore every wall. But they'll never take what we carry in our souls. Teach your children the truth, let it live in their veins. This land is ours, no matter the change. That was our village. Now it's dust and it's pain. They came from the west with their guns and their chains. But remember these fields, remember our name. One day we'll return, I swear it again. So walk with me, son, don't turn.
The contrast between daily life in more stable regions and the experiences of Palestinians living under occupation or conflict is stark. For many of us, basic freedoms like moving freely, expressing opinions, or accessing healthcare are taken for granted. Palestinians, however, often face restrictions on movement, limited access to essential services, and the constant threat of violence or displacement. While we might worry about career goals or weekend plans, Palestinians often grapple with existential concerns. Will their homes be safe tonight? Will their children have access to education tomorrow? Even simple acts, like gathering with family, can be overshadowed by checkpoints, curfews, or military operations. We wake up every morning, lulled by the monotony of routines we scarcely question. The alarm chimes insistently, signaling the start of another day. We eat breakfast, a bowl of cereal perhaps, or a quick piece of toast, and sip our coffee or tea, steeling ourselves for the tasks ahead. We get ready for work, meticulously preparing for meetings, projects, and deadlines. If we have children, we shepherd them through the chaos of the morning, packing lunches, zipping backpacks, ensuring they are dressed, fed, and prepared for school or the day's activities. We move through these motions with the subconscious assurance that we are fulfilling our role, that everything is, at least for now, secure. Traffic becomes our first complaint of the day. We sit in our cars, inching along congested roads, grumbling about delays and detours. The irony is sharp. Many on the other side of the world have no cars, no roads, no paths paved with privilege. Perhaps they navigate rugged terrain barefoot, or traverse long distances by foot, carrying their lives on their backs. Their mornings, unlike ours, are not cushioned by the conveniences we so often take for granted. We lament rising costs, the price of gas, heat, and groceries climbing higher with each passing week. Yet even as we groan at the checkout counter, our carts are full. On the other side of the world, there are no such complaints, for there are no such luxuries. Without cars to fuel, homes to heat, or currency to spend, they face a different reality entirely. Their struggle is not one of tightening budgets, but of sheer survival. How do you complain about everything you lost or what you've never had? We continue with our day. We meet new people, colleagues, baristas, fellow shoppers, and exchange polite, their reality is starker. Communities are confined to the few who remain, living in tents huddled together. If they are fortunate, they have a tent at all. Their interactions are not with strangers over lattes, but with neighbors who share the burden of survival. These are bonds forged not in passing moments, but in shared hardship, in the collective struggle to endure. Evening comes, and we retreat to the sanctuary of home. We cook a warm meal, savoring the aromas that fill our kitchens. We set the table, dine with our families, and recount the highlights of our day, a project completed, a funny anecdote, a minor annoyance. The chatter is light, punctuated by laughter or the clink of silverware. Afterward, we unwind in front of the TV, selecting a show or movie to ease us into rest. And then the screen shifts. Images flash across it, scenes of devastation, of war, of unimaginable loss. We watch as people on the other side of the world bury their children, cradle their loved ones, and search through rubble for remnants of their lives. We see their tears, their grief, their despair, and we are silent. We sit in our living rooms, far removed, insulated by distance and circumstance. We do not speak of the bombs that fall, or the lives that are shattered. Perhaps we feel helpless, or perhaps we have simply grown accustomed to the horror. Deep down, we know. We know that our tax dollars fund these tragedies, that our government plays a role in the suffering we witness. A few of us voice dissent, questioning the decisions made in our name. But for most, the questions go unasked. It is easier to believe in the righteousness of our government, to accept its actions as necessary, as justified. After all, the suffering is on the other side of the world, far from our comfortable homes and familiar routines. And so, we continue. We wake up every morning. You are listening to This Week in Palestine. The United States has a long-standing relationship with Israel, marked by significant financial and military support. This includes billions of dollars in aid annually, primarily through the Foreign Military Financing Program. For example, the U.S. provides approximately $3.3 billion each year for military assistance, alongside $500 million for cooperative missile defense programs. This funding supports Israel's ability to maintain its military edge in the region, often referred to as its qualitative military edge. Additionally, the U.S. engages in joint military exercises, weapons development, and counterterrorism initiatives with Israel. Over the decades, the total assistance has exceeded $130 billion, reflecting the depth of this partnership. This support stems from shared strategic interests and a commitment to ensuring Israel's security, though it has often come at the expense of Palestinian lives, rights, and aspirations. The Israeli people are living their best life. They have access to free hospitals, free schools, free colleges, and free homes. A robust social safety net ensures that their basic needs are met, offering a level of security and comfort that many around the world can only dream of. Their lives are supported by a well-organized and well-funded system, and this stability extends into their sense of safety. They are armed to the teeth, equipped with advanced military technology and weapons, all under the banner of protecting themselves from perceived threats chief among them, the Palestinians. On the other side of the divide, Palestinians live under circumstances that starkly contrast this prosperity. Entire communities are confined behind fences and walls, under tight control that defines their movements, their opportunities, and their lives. The tragic reality is one of restrictions, checkpoints, and limitations that deny them even the most basic freedoms. These fences symbolize a chasm that is not merely physical, but deeply social and economic, a separation that divides lives into two vastly different realities. The funding that makes Israel's robust systems possible includes significant financial and military assistance from the United States. Like we said earlier, over the decades, the U.S. has provided more than $130 billion to Israel, funneling resources into its military, technology, and development. This financial backing has allowed Israel to thrive as a nation, securing its place as a dominant force in the region. However, the cost of this support raises pressing questions when viewed through the lens of America's own challenges. Consider what $130 billion could have achieved within the United States. The figure is staggering enough to transform lives and address systemic issues that have plagued the nation for decades. For instance, the homelessness crisis that casts a shadow over so many cities could have been significantly mitigated, if not entirely resolved. Millions of Americans, including families with children, veterans, and individuals grappling with economic hardships, could have found stable housing and the opportunity to rebuild their lives. Education, too, stands as a stark example of what could have been. With $130 billion, the dream of college education could have been made accessible to countless young Americans. Student debt, a burden that haunts millions, might have been eased, allowing a generation to pursue their goals without the weight of financial despair. The ripple effects of such an investment in education would have been profound, strengthening the workforce and empowering individuals to contribute more fully to society. Healthcare, often the source of financial ruin for many, could have been another area of transformation. The cost of medical care in the United States remains a barrier for countless individuals and families. With these funds, health costs could have been lowered, more clinics could have been built, and essential services could have been expanded to reach the underserved. Preventative care could have been prioritized, reducing long-term healthcare costs and improving the quality of life for millions. And yet, the funds were spent elsewhere supporting a foreign nation, while domestic struggles remained unaddressed. This choice speaks to the priorities set by those in power, priorities that often seem disconnected from the pressing needs of everyday Americans. While the Israeli people benefit from this arrangement, living secure and supported lives, Palestinians endure hardships that are difficult to comprehend. And back in the United States, many are left wondering why resources are so readily available for others, yet so scarce when it comes to addressing problems at home. This disparity invites reflection. What does it mean to support one nation's prosperity while another's struggles are overlooked? What could have been achieved if the $130 billion had been invested in America's future, rather than in foreign conflicts? These are difficult questions, but they are necessary ones, questions that challenge the narrative of priorities and force a deeper consideration of what could and should be done to create a more equitable world, both at home and abroad. Should we ask ourselves why we keep electing presidents who seem more focused on fame and power than on the well-being of the American people? Time and again, we see leaders who prioritize their own legacies, their own ambitions, over the lives of millions, both here at home and overseas. This pattern raises uncomfortable questions about the choices we make as voters and the consequences of those choices for our nation and the world. The U.S. national debt, now exceeding $33 trillion, looms large over our economy. This staggering figure does not even include the annual federal budget, which stands at $6.4 trillion and continues to grow year after year. The debt is a ticking time bomb, a burden that future generations will inherit unless decisive action is taken. How long can the United States sustain this level of debt? How long before the weight of it becomes too much to bear? The possibility of an economic collapse is no longer a distant hypothetical. It is a very real concern. With our current administration, the risk feels palpable. The decisions being made today will shape the trajectory of our economy for years to come, and the stakes could not be higher. If the American economy were to collapse, the ripple effects would be felt across the globe. But one question stands out: would Israel stand by the United States in such a scenario? Israel has long been a close ally of the U.S., benefiting from billions of dollars in financial and military aid. This relationship has been built on shared strategic interests and mutual support. But alliances are often tested in times of crisis. If the U.S. were to face an economic collapse, would Israel continue to stand by its side? Or would it prioritize its own survival, distancing itself from a faltering partner? The answer to this question is complex, rooted in the dynamics of international relations and the realities of self-interest. Israel's reliance on U.S. support has been a cornerstone of its security and prosperity. Yet, in the face of an American economic collapse, the calculus could change. Nations act in their own best interests, and Israel would likely weigh the risks and benefits of maintaining its close ties to a struggling United States. This scenario underscores the importance of electing leaders who prioritize the long-term stability and prosperity of the nation. Leaders who understand the gravity of the challenges we face, and who are committed to addressing them with integrity and foresight. It is not enough to elect presidents who seek fame or who focus on short-term gains. We need leaders who are willing to make difficult decisions, who are guided by principles rather than personal ambition. As voters, we hold the power to shape the future of our nation. It is our responsibility to ask tough questions, to demand accountability, and to make informed choices. The stakes are too high to settle for anything less. The decisions we make today will determine whether we can overcome the challenges ahead, or whether we will succumb to them. The question of whether Israel would stand by the United States in the event of an economic collapse is just one piece of a larger puzzle. It is a reminder of the interconnectedness of nations and the importance of strong, principled leadership. As we reflect on the choices we make as voters, let us also consider the broader implications of those choices for our nation and for the millions of lives affected by our decisions. Across the globe, countries are increasingly facing pressure from Israel to suppress voices advocating for Palestinian freedom. For decades, Israeli influence has worked to stifle dissent and silence those who challenge its actions in the region. This influence extends far and wide, shaping policies in other countries to suppress support for Palestine and its people. In Germany, independent journalist and writer Hanno Hauenstein uncovered a concerning example of this influence. Berlin's immigration authorities have initiated moves to deport four young foreign residents based on allegations related to participation in protests against Israel's war on Gaza. What makes this case particularly alarming is that none of these individuals have been convicted of any crimes. Such an unprecedented action raises serious questions about civil liberties and the shrinking space for dissent in Germany, a country that prides itself on democratic values and free speech. But we do not need to look so far to see examples of this suppression. It is happening right here in the United States. Advocacy for Palestinian rights is often met with backlash, censorship, and even threats. University campuses, once a stronghold of free expression, have become battlegrounds for Palestinian students and their allies. Palestinian students attending Israeli universities, in particular, face significant challenges. Since October 7, any have been subjected to harassment, suspension, or even arrest simply for expressing their views. The situation has been poignantly described by Guevara Bader, who shed light on the schizophrenic existence these students endure, forced to suppress their identity and emotions, unable to openly address the ongoing carnage in Gaza, all the while carrying the weight of guilt for their relative safety. These examples illustrate a chilling trend: the erosion of fundamental freedoms under the guise of maintaining political alliances or stability. The suppression of speech and advocacy undermines democratic principles and leaves little room for constructive dialogue. As these pressures intensify, the world must confront an uncomfortable question: is the cost of aligning with Israeli interests worth the sacrifice of civil liberties and the silencing of justice for Palestinians? You are listening to This Week in Palestine. Recent events highlight growing tensions and humanitarian crises. In Jinba, West Bank, Israeli settlers supported by the army attacked residents, leaving injuries and destruction. In Gaza, hospitals face collapse under Israel's blockade, with patients dying due to a dismantled health system. Reports suggest plans to displace Gaza's population into restrictive areas akin to concentration camps. Internationally, protests against Gaza's war have led to deportation attempts in Berlin, raising civil liberties concerns. Meanwhile, Palestinian students in Israeli universities face harassment and suppression, navigating a hostile environment while grappling with guilt and identity struggles. These developments reflect escalating violence and systemic challenges. On March 28, the West Bank village of Jinba became the site of a harrowing attack that exposed the stark realities faced by vulnerable communities in the region. Israeli settlers, emboldened by the full backing of the Israeli army, launched a violent assault on the village. Residents were subjected to physical attacks, with one child left bleeding from a head injury, a reminder of the indiscriminate nature of such violence. The settlers' actions were not isolated. They were part of a broader pattern of aggression that has long plagued Palestinian communities. What made this incident even more alarming was the direct involvement of the Israeli army. After the initial assault, some of the same settlers returned to Jinba, this time dressed in army uniforms. Their presence in official military attire blurred the lines between civilian aggression and state-sanctioned violence. They proceeded to ransack the village, leaving destruction in their wake. Homes were torn apart, belongings were scattered, and the very fabric of the community was disrupted. For the residents of Jinba, the attack was not just a physical assault, but a psychological one, instilling fear and uncertainty about their safety and future. The incident highlights the devastating impact of such actions on communities that are already marginalized and struggling to survive. Jinba, like many other villages in the West Bank, faces constant threats to its existence. The combination of settler violence and military intervention creates an environment where residents are forced to live in a state of perpetual insecurity. Their homes, their livelihoods, and their sense of stability are under constant siege. This attack also raises broader questions about accountability and justice. The settlers' actions, carried out with the support and participation of the army, point to a systemic issue that goes beyond individual acts of violence. It underscores the need for international attention and intervention to address the ongoing violations of human rights in the region. For the residents of Jinba, the path to recovery will be long and fraught with challenges, but their resilience in the face of such adversity remains a testament to the human spirit. As Israel's military onslaught intensifies and the blockade on Gaza tightens, the healthcare system in the Strip teeters on the edge of collapse. Hospitals, once sanctuaries for the sick and injured, are now overwhelmed and barely functioning. This dire situation is not accidental. It reflects a deliberate strategy aimed at dismantling Gaza's healthcare infrastructure. The blockade has created severe shortages of essential medical supplies, fuel for generators, and even clean water, leaving hospitals unable to provide basic care. Patients who could otherwise be treated are left to endure a slow and silent demise, as Mahmoud Mushtaha poignantly described. Inside these hospitals, the scenes are heartbreaking. Wounded individuals crowd the hallways, waiting for care that may never come. Doctors and nurses, stretched beyond their limits, struggle to save lives with dwindling resources. The lack of anesthesia, antibiotics, and other critical medicines means that even routine procedures become life-threatening. Patients with chronic conditions, such as kidney failure or heart disease, face an agonizing wait for treatment that may never arrive. For many, the wait ends in preventable deaths, slow, painful, and utterly avoidable. This collapse of Gaza's healthcare system is not just a humanitarian crisis. It is a calculated tactic that exacerbates the suffering of an already besieged population. The blockade and military actions have systematically stripped the region of its ability to care for its people, turning hospitals into places of despair rather than healing. The human toll of these policies is devastating, with countless lives lost and families shattered. The international community has been slow to respond, despite urgent appeals from Gaza's health ministry and humanitarian organizations. Calls to open crossings for medical supplies and fuel have largely gone unanswered, leaving the people of Gaza trapped in a cycle of suffering. The situation demands immediate action to prevent further loss of life and to restore dignity to those who are enduring unimaginable hardships. The collapse of Gaza's healthcare system is a stark reminder of the profound human cost of conflict and the urgent need for accountability and intervention. Israel is reportedly planning to forcibly displace the entire population of Gaza, a move that has drawn widespread condemnation for its devastating implications. Through a combination of evacuation orders and relentless bombardment, the aim appears to be the relocation of Gaza's residents into enclosed, potentially fenced-off areas. These areas, stripped of resources and basic necessities, would leave the displaced population to face starvation and desperation. Such a strategy has been described in stark terms as resembling a concentration camp, underscoring the gravity of the situation. The humanitarian crisis this plan would create is almost unimaginable. Gaza, already suffering from years of blockade and conflict, is home to over 2 million people, many of whom are children. Forcibly uprooting an entire population would not only violate international law, but also exacerbate the suffering of a community that has endured decades of hardship. The lack of access to food, clean water, medical care, and shelter would lead to widespread suffering and loss of life, creating a catastrophe of unprecedented scale. This strategy also raises profound ethical and moral questions. The deliberate targeting of civilians and the use of starvation as a weapon are clear violations of human rights and international humanitarian law. The international community has a responsibility to intervene and prevent such actions from taking place. Failure to do so would not only result in immense human suffering, but also set a dangerous precedent for the treatment of vulnerable populations in conflict zones. The implications of this plan extend beyond Gaza. It threatens to destabilize the region further, fueling anger, resentment, and potential retaliation. The displacement of millions of people would create a refugee crisis that neighboring countries may struggle to manage, adding to the already volatile dynamics of the Middle East. The global community must act decisively to address this unfolding crisis and uphold the principles of human dignity and justice. Nora Barrows Friedman has reported extensively on the devastating situation in Gaza through the Electronic Intifada. Her coverage highlights the systematic destruction and violence carried out by Israeli forces, including the targeting of children and the burning of tents and shelters. The targeting of children has been particularly harrowing, with UNICEF reporting an average of 100 Palestinian children killed or injured daily during intensified attacks. Let's listen to her reporting.
Here's a brief summary of some of the latest developments this week in Palestine. Israel has committed massacres across all areas of the Gaza Strip, while for 6 weeks now it has closed all the crossings for food, fuel, medicines, construction vehicles, and every other essential supply, plunging Gaza into another deep starvation and health crisis. More than 390,000 people are estimated to have been displaced again, according to the United Nations, with no safe place to go. Every day, dozens are killed in Israeli attacks. The Palestinian Health Ministry in Gaza said that in the last 3 weeks since Israel broke the ceasefire on March 18th, Israel has killed nearly 1,500 Palestinians. Al Jazeera reporter Anas Al-Sharif shared this video of Israeli fire belt strikes hitting Gaza City on April 3rd. Our contributor Abu Bakr Abed has been reporting on the attacks over the last week on Deir al-Balah in central Gaza, where his cousin and his cousin's child were killed at the gates of the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Hospital on Saturday. The Israeli army has issued forced expulsion orders to residents of Deir al-Balah in the past few days, threatening residents with attacks if they do not leave. The Israeli military said that it carried out 45 separate attacks across Gaza between Tuesday and Wednesday alone. On Wednesday, April 9th, Israel attacked the Shejaiya neighborhood of Gaza City, destroying dozens of residential buildings and killing dozens of Palestinians. An eyewitness told the Al Jazeera network that, quote, "We were talking in the street and suddenly we were shocked to see these buildings' bricks flying apart, in addition to flying hands and feet." Another survivor added, quote, "It is a massacre with the full meaning of the word. I haven't seen or heard about a massacre like this since the start of the war. Most of the martyrs are children and defenseless civilians." Mahmoud Bassal, the spokesperson for Gaza's Civil Defense Corps, said that there were dozens of people missing and stuck underneath the rubble. Al Jazeera's reporter Hani Mahmoud said on Wednesday that, quote, "The army not only dropped multiple bombs, but these were also earthquake bombs that shook the very foundations of nearby buildings, destroying the majority of them. Entire residential buildings have been turned into ruins. A large number of casualties arrived at Al-Ahli Arab Hospital in Gaza City, but they are struggling because there is not sufficient medical care available due to shortages of supplies and doctors." Mahmoud said that civil defense crews needed to stop their rescue operations because armed Israeli quadcopter drones hovered above them. Also on Wednesday, Israeli airstrikes bombed the tents of displaced families in the so-called safe zone of Al-Mawasi, killing three Palestinians, including a child. The day before, on April 8th, Israel bombed Al-Mawasi. Doctors Without Borders said that its teams in the nearby clinic received nine victims after a strike hit 300 meters away from the facility. Two were dead on arrival, including a two-year-old boy, and the seven others were wounded. Excuse me. Dr. Mohammed Shath, an emergency room doctor working at the clinic, said, quote, "Honestly, I can't describe the scene and the injuries in the stomach, head, and chest. Absolute horror." On April 7th, Israel bombed a community kitchen also in Al-Mawasi that was distributing meals to displaced families. Four children were killed in the airstrike. This video by journalist Samar Abu Samra shows a man carrying the body of a small girl who is wearing a traditional Palestinian thobe. He says, quote, "Look, they're all children, all of them." Another man says that the kitchen workers were distributing rice and lentils to children and Israel bombed them. And another witness says that the girl is 5 and the oldest of the children who were killed was 6. "This is so wrong," he says. "Nothing in the world justifies the killing of children."
كم شهيد فيه؟
حتى الآن يمكن 4 كلهم أطفال.
شو كان بعمل؟
والله كان بوزع رز قاعدين رز. والله رز كان بوزع عدس. والله رز وعدس بوزع على أطفال ضربوهم. أخوي راح. أنا 5 سنين 6 سنين أكبر بنت فيها. حرام والله الله ما بقولها يا زلمة طنيات يموتوا. إيش يعني؟ راح يجيبوا أكل ياكلوا. إيش يا عمي؟ خلصونا. شو هذا؟ إيش وكل؟ أجيبهم أكل ما تروح عندك إياه.
In the south, the Gaza government media office said on April 7th that Rafah is, quote, "the city that the Israeli occupation wiped off the map and turned into a complete humanitarian disaster." The media office stated that Israel has transformed the entire Rafah governorate, quote, "into a closed military operations zone, completely isolating it from the rest of the Gaza Strip and considering it a complete red zone. It continues to commit horrific massacres against defenseless civilians, causing the systematic and comprehensive destruction of infrastructure, vital facilities, and residential homes, rendering the city uninhabitable." The occupation army, the media office added, quote, "has completely destroyed more than 90% of the homes in Rafah governorate, representing more than 20,000 buildings containing more than 50,000 housing units. In addition, 22 of the 24 water wells were destroyed, including the main Canada well, and the distribution pumps, depriving tens of thousands of families of safe drinking water." The isolated Rafah governorate was not only bombed, but was systematically destroyed and obliterated in a scene that reflects the occupation's premeditated intent to empty the land of its people and alter its geographic and demographic features, the office stated. Quote, "We affirm that these crimes will not pass without accountability and that the steadfastness of the people of Rafah Governorate and the rest of our people will remain a living witness that the will to live is stronger than the machine of death." The Palestinian Health Ministry in Gaza reported this week that while medical teams and ambulance crews continue to operate under life-threatening conditions to save lives, 37% of medications and 59% of all medical supplies are at zero stock. This includes medications for operating rooms, intensive care units, and emergency departments that have been depleted to unprecedented levels, with higher percentages of critical medications being at zero stock, such as 54% of medications for cancer treatment, 40% of those for primary care, and 51% of medicines for maternal and child health. Furthermore, the destruction of diagnostic imaging equipment has severely restricted patients' access to these vital services, while fuel shortages threaten to shut down hospitals' essential departments that rely on generators, the health ministry added. The UN Children's Fund, UNICEF, warned this week that Israel's ongoing blockade of humanitarian aid is having terrible consequences for 1 million children in the Gaza Strip. And without essential food, medicine, shelter, and safe water, malnutrition, diseases, and other preventable conditions will likely surge, leading to an increase in preventable child deaths. UNICEF said that complementary food for infants, which are crucial for growth when food stocks are low, has run out in central and southern Gaza. Israel murdered 3 journalists this week in Gaza. On April 5th, an Israeli airstrike bombed the home of journalist Islam Mekdad in Khan Yunis, killing her and her son Adam, along with 5 other members of her family. On April 7th, Helmi Al-Fakawi, who worked for the Palestine Today news agency, was killed when an Israeli airstrike targeted a media tent outside of the Nasser Hospital complex in Khan Yunis. Another man, Yusuf Al-Khandizar, was also killed. Helmi's colleague, reporter Ahmed Mansour, was engulfed in flames as colleagues desperately attempted to save him. Mansour was left in critical condition with life-threatening injuries and succumbed to his wounds on Tuesday. A witness to the airstrike told Middle East Eye that those in the tent, quote, tried desperately to rescue Ahmed Mansour from the flames, but there were no resources available, as the foam, wood, and nylon in the tent quickly caught fire. The Gaza government media office said that 8 other journalists were injured in the attack. The media office adds that 211 reporters have now been killed in Gaza since October 2023. Euromed Human Rights Monitor condemned the public escalation of the slaughter of journalists. The organization's legal department director, Lima Bustani, stated that, quote, burning a journalist alive in Gaza is not aimed at silencing the truth. Israel already relies on a far greater force, the world's indifference to the truth. Bustami explained that Israel's systematic targeting of Palestinian journalists also sends a chilling message. Your truth means nothing. We can kill you with the camera in your hand, and no one will save you. She added that Israel's crimes against Palestinian journalists is, quote, a performance of power and a declaration of impunity in action. We've published many features on the Electronic Intifada in the last week, but we wanted to highlight excerpts of Starvation and Solitary Confinement, 14 Months in Israeli Prison, by Abdullah Yunus, writing from Gaza. Abdullah profiles the journalist Ahmed Shakoura, a friend of his who was arrested in December 2023 and detained inside Israeli prisons for more than a year. He said he lost around 138 pounds during his detention. Quote, I have known Shakoura, who is 37 years old, for 4 years. Our friendship developed while he was a trainer for a course I took on digital media in Gaza City in 2021. He works for the Palestine Today news agency and is married with 5 children. He's also a skilled cook and enjoys swimming and playing electronic strategy games. I met up with Shakoura in the Al Rimal neighborhood in March. It was noon, and we sat outside under the sunshine that he had missed seeing during his 14-month detention. He was one of 369 Palestinian prisoners released by Israel in a February exchange for 3 Israeli prisoners. We found no place to sit and talk except on the rubble of the destroyed houses around us. Shakoura told me he had been listening to the news of the Israeli military invasion of Gaza City on the radio in his home when soldiers arrived and demanded via loudspeaker that the residents leave their homes and surrender. Shakoura said the men were told to strip down to their underwear. The soldiers tied me with 3 strong plastic handcuffs and blindfolded me so that I could not see anything, he said, pointing to the wounds still visible on his hands. These handcuffs caused severe harm to my hands. They crushed my skin and flesh and reached the bone. The Israeli soldiers took Shakoura and a group of his male neighbors by bus northward to the Israeli military base in Zikim. For 18 hours straight, we were not allowed to drink water or relieve ourselves, and despite being very cold, we were not allowed to wear any clothes, he recalled. The Israeli army then transferred Shakoura to the notorious Sde Tayman military camp. I was still blindfolded and handcuffed, and they made me sit on gravel with rough edges. It caused me injuries in my leg. I remained like that for 5 days in a row. Shakoura was then transferred to the Al-Jalameh prison in central Israel for 140 days, which he described as the most brutal period of his imprisonment. For 5 continuous hours on the road to Al-Jalameh, the soldiers beat me severely with iron rods. I did not know that there were other detainees with me until I heard their screams while they were being beaten, like me, Shakoura said, mentioning that he was blindfolded the whole time. When he was released on February 15th, he said he did not know whether his wife and children were still alive. When the bus arrived in Gaza, I saw my wife and children waiting for me. When they saw me, they didn't recognize me at first because I had lost so much weight that I no longer looked like they remembered. He said my children looked at me, unsure if I was their father or not. but their doubts faded when I smiled at them and rushed to embrace them. At that time, I felt great joy and thanked God a lot. Shakura is now receiving medical and psychological care at an outpatient government program at Nasser Medical Complex in Khan Yunis. He has returned to work as a journalist and also hopes to open a restaurant in Gaza one day. Those are excerpts from Starvation and Solitary Confinement, 14 Months in Israeli Prison by Abdullah Yunus, writing from Gaza on electronicintifada.net. Turning to the occupied West Bank, my colleague Tamara Nassar writes that Israel is subjecting Palestinian children in the West Bank to a campaign of systematic ethnic cleansing, according to the human rights group Defense for Children International Palestine. Since the beginning of the year, Israel has killed 20 children in the West Bank. In the latest case on Sunday, April 6th, Israeli soldiers shot three Palestinian children, including two with American citizenship, in the town of Tur Musayyah. One of the three died as a result. The town's mayor said the three boys were picking green almonds from a field near Route 60, a highway used by Israeli settlers that crosses the West Bank. Palestinian-American Amar Rabi, 14 years old, was killed by Israeli fire. Israeli soldiers shot his 15-year-old friend Ayub Jabbar, also an American citizen, and he was placed in intensive care following the attack. Their friend Abdul Rahman Shahada, 15, was hospitalized as well. The Israeli army called the three children terrorists in a post on X that shows a few seconds of grainy footage that allegedly captures the moment they were shot. The Israeli army did not even try to claim that the boys had thrown anything other than rocks. Amr's video said, however, that the video is not accurate and contains no evidence that his son had even thrown rocks. There were six bullets in his body, two in his heart, two in his shoulder, and two in his face, Amr's father told a reporter with the French news agency AFP. Also this month, the Israeli army shot and killed 16-year-old Omar Amr Zayoud near the city of Jenin in the northern West Bank. An Israeli soldier in a heavily armored military vehicle shot Omar from a distance of about 80 meters on April 2nd, according to Defense for Children International Palestine. He was near a school by the entrance of the Palestinian town of Silat al-Harithiyah, northwest of Jenin. Omar was allegedly throwing stones and explosive devices alongside other youth at two military vehicles. Israeli soldiers continue targeting children with deadly force, with no accountability, because world leaders allow them to act without consequence, said Ayed Abu Akhtesh, Accountability Program Director at DCIP. For much more, read Tamara's report, Israel Kills Children Routinely in West Bank, on electronicintifada.net. Along with destroying children's rights to live, Israeli soldiers are trying to destroy their rights to learn as well. On April 8th, Israeli officials, accompanied by police, raided six separate UN-run schools in occupied Jerusalem and announced plans to close them within 30 days. Philippe Lazzarini, the head of UNRWA, the UN Agency for Palestine Refugees, said that, quote, some 800 boys and girls are directly impacted by these closure orders and are likely to miss finishing their school year. UNRWA schools are protected by the privileges and immunities of the United Nations. Today's unauthorized entries and issuance of closure orders are a violation of these protections and represent a revocation of Israel's obligations under international law, he said. These illegal closure orders come in the wake of Israeli Knesset legislation seeking to curtail UNRWA operations, Lazzarini stated. Al Jazeera correspondent Nour Oda said that the closure of the UNRWA schools is, quote, extremely problematic because the children would likely end up at Israeli institutions run by the Jerusalem municipality. She explained that the children admitted to Israeli schools would no longer be taught under the Palestinian curriculum, but rather under an Israeli curriculum that erases Palestinian identity and history. Meanwhile, Israeli forces are expanding their military attacks across the occupied West Bank and continue to destroy homes inside the Jenin refugee camp. The army also conducted heavy raids on Nablus and the Balata refugee camp on Wednesday. The Wafa news agency reported that Israeli occupation forces invaded the camp in the pre-dawn hours of Wednesday, deploying troops extensively inside and sealing off the camp's entrances. The soldiers ordered families to leave their homes at gunpoint and then ransacked them. Palestine Red Crescent paramedics said that during the invasion of Balata, six Palestinians were shot and injured by Israeli soldiers, four with live ammunition and two with rubber-coated steel bullets. A child was hit in the face by a tear gas canister, and dozens more suffered from tear gas inhalation. And early this morning, April 10th, 23-year-old Ahmed Manasra was released from Israeli prisons after spending 10 years inside and enduring what the Palestinian Prisoners Club says was physical and psychological torture, including solitary confinement, since his arrest in 2016. The Jerusalem Prisoner Committees said that the Israeli army released Manasra far from the Nafha prison in the Naqab, where he was imprisoned, while his family awaited his release at the prison gate. A Bedouin resident in the Beersheba area recognized the 23-year-old, contacted his family, and informed them of their son's release. Our colleague Omar Karmi wrote in 2022 that Manasra's case came to wider public attention in 2015 when a leaked video of his interrogation was broadcast by Palestinian media. The footage shows an Israeli interrogator hurling abuse at the boy and accusing him repeatedly of attempted murder, despite the boy's insistence that he did not have any memory of any stabbings. Manasra was just 13 when he and a cousin, Hassan, 15, allegedly went to the Pisgat Ze'ev settlement in occupied East Jerusalem with the intention, his lawyer, Leat Semel, said, to scare Jews so they'd stop killing Palestinians. According to the indictment, Hassan stabbed a security guard who was lightly injured. They then chased an Israeli boy, 13, whom Hassan had also stabbed and critically injured. When they tried to escape, Hassan was shot and killed by Israeli police, which operate in occupied East Jerusalem. Manasra, meanwhile, was hit by a car as he ran away. Disturbing footage uploaded later saw the seriously hurt Manasra surrounded by Israelis shouting curses at the boy as he lay on the ground. The indictment against him did not at any point suggest that Manasra had himself stabbed anyone, and the boy denied any intention to murder, to which prosecutors had wanted him to confess. That's from Omar Karmi's 2022 report. Ahmed Manasra case highlights Israel's cruelty to Palestinian children. Manasra spent the last 10 years in Israeli prisons and held in solitary confinement for the past 5 months, which has worsened his mental health condition, according to the family's lawyer. Finally, as we always do, we wanted to highlight people expressing joy, determination, and resilience across Palestine. Afif Nasouli, a journalist and volunteer with the medical solidarity organization GLIA, posted this clip of himself on the beach near Khan Yunis this week. He writes, quote, "I know you're seeing terrible things coming out of Gaza right now, and I'm glad advocates are sharing the images and the realities in the north. The loudness of strikes and drones is torturous. The images are hard to watch because they are truly happening to human beings that are just down the way. But Gaza, but Gaza is so much more than Israel's demolition derby, and Palestinians are so much more than their suffering in this moment. My heart is having a hard time adding to the barrage of images that convey the reality of genocide, because I don't want to make my time here about sharing images you already have. I went to the beach for a walk after doing some work in Khan Yunis the other day, and I wanted to share with you the ultimate resistance. Palestinian kids having a little bit of fun, even amidst strikes and drones and death. They are the future of this nation, and their health and happiness is the purest form of resisting this mass murder." Afif adds that a colleague of his told him something that so many in Gaza express about the beach. "The beach is the one place that the war can't change or steal from us." Here is Afif on the beach.
That's funny. Did he start it or did you? They're all doing it. That's so cute.
I just saw one with it.
Afif, how's it going?
Good.
I am some caffeine into.
That's Afif Nasuli in Khan Yunis. And that's it for the news roundup. As always, go to electronicintifada.net for much more, especially to read our new features by our brave writers in Gaza.
We are officially out of time. If you have any questions or would you like to support us in any way, please email me at twipodcasts@gmail.com. I would like to thank you for listening, and I would like to thank the team that is working behind the scene to make this show happen. Many thanks to Bob Funk, Stanley Robinson, Mohammed Alghul, Anne Lucas, Stephen Lowe, Sophia Rose Woolman, Lesh Tran, and Tahani Abu Mosa. This Week in Palestine is a production of Truth and Justice Radio, currently at the home of WZBC Student Radio at Boston College. As always, we thank you for spending your time with us today as we continue to work towards Palestinian liberation. See you next week.
That was our home. Where we laughed and we loved. That big farm right there with the olives so green. They stole it from us. You know what that means. We harvested life from the roots of these trees. Now they're strangers' hands. Taking all that we need. Look, son, that was our village. Now it's dust and it's pain. They came from the west with their guns and their chains. But remember these fields. Remember our name. One day we'll return. I swear it again. We gathered here, family, under the moon. Stories and songs now all gone too soon. They burned every door, they tore every wall. But they'll never take what we carry in our souls. Teach the children the truth, let it live in their veins. This land is ours, no matter the chains. Through fire and time, through exile and years, our roots run too deep to be washed by their tears. Look, son, that was our village. Now it's dust and it's pain. They came from the west with their guns and their chains. But remember these fields. Remember our name. One day we'll return. I swear it again. So walk with me, son. Don't turn away. Hold this land in your heart every day. For as long as we return to our home again. Look, son, I'm still holding the key.